Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Well, hello there. God, I hate this. Is why I don't like doing intros. G'day. Welcome to Bilge Pumps, episode 99. Today it's myself, Jamie Seidel from Armoured Carriers, the website, plus the YouTube channel, both of which are ridiculous time sinks. Nevertheless, still good fun. And of course, here is Draconophil himself, also of the website and YouTube channel of the same name. Actually, have you named your website?
It is literally draconophil.co.uk.
Okay, well, there you have it. Makes it easy for both of us to remember that. And this week, Dr. Clark is gallivanting around the countryside, trying to herd teenage cats.
Yes.
Both of the male and female variety, which I understand is separated by one flight of stairs. So being an insomniac, he's already told us that he'll be sleeping in the stairwell.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't envy him that. I have occasionally toyed with the idea of teaching people, but if I was going to teach people, I would at least like to either teach people who are vaguely functional adults, even if my experience at university have taught me that most people become functional alcoholics before they become functional adults, or else primary school kids, because then you can just literally pick them up and put them in places you want them to be.
These days you get sued for that, so yeah, might not be an option.
No, teenagers are an interesting species, but not one I would ever have to want to spend large amounts of time in charge of.
Indeed. And speaking of such, I thought it's probably time that we gave a plug to our SimSec hosts. Mm. Sea Control, that's the official podcast of SimSec. We are these sort of stowaway hangers-on, feeding off of the charity down here in the bilges. But in comparison to our bilge, Sea Control is, I suppose they have the gin in the officer's wardroom cabinet, aren't they?
Yeah.
These guys actually know what they're talking about, for one thing. You know, recently they've had some fantastic interviews, which quite frankly I'm a bit jealous of. But they've also touched on quite a few topics that bilge perennials, such as the South China Sea and the Chinese hypersonic carrier killing missiles, and not to mention things such as sea lift. I'm sure that Sal would have been pleased to hear that one. So yeah, look, you know, come to us down here in the bilges. Not that the bilges are all that bad. I mean, you know, in the bilges we generally find out what they've been drinking in the wardroom the night before. And if you do a little bit of a closer analysis in the bilges, you can probably find out whether they've been mixing other illicit substances with the gin. And occasionally we might even get one of those nuclear launch keys slipping down through the cracks after a particularly hard night on the terps in the officer's mess. But that's where you go to get the real stuff.
I suppose the main problem that Sea Control probably experiences is that to get that higher level of regular interviewees, I mean, we've had some pretty good, pretty high level ones as well. Mm. But for the more specifically the active naval side of things that they sometimes get, they do have to. Well, I suspect our kind of occasional ranting probably is actually quite popular with the serving naval crew, but the politicians who authorize them to come and give those interviews in the first place are probably slightly less enthused with our views on
them. They're enthused to hear it as well, I suppose.
Yeah.
Or at least from those directions. I mean, that's why we're down here in the bilges. You know, we can stink as much as we want because, A, you know, none of us actually have any close affiliations with any military, and we're just a bunch of old hacks and young hacks who happen to like the material. Maybe not Dr. Clark. He might have a few more fingers and a few more pies than us, but
See,
he's not here today, so we can let it rip.
Sea Control is kind of like the eminent professor on stage giving out awards and speeches and plaudits of thanks to all the various great and the good, and we're the peanut gallery who can express our true feelings.
Yes and no. I mean, yeah, they do tackle some interesting subjects. Anyway, so that wasn't supposed to be an advert. It was just that I've heard a few of their back inventory lately while I've been driving around and thinking, ooh, this is good.
Yeah.
So how do we compete with them today?
Right. Well, there's a few different things we can talk about. There's everything from training ships to, believe it or not, a British attempt to set up a museum ship, although in classic style of almost every museum ship we've actually ended up setting up, it's basically sunken and decrepit at the moment, all the complete reconditioning, because, you know, no one ever actually preserves these things. In fact, actually, come to think of it, I'm trying to think of any of the front end top line museum ships in the UK that weren't in that condition at some point or other.
Well,
Victory.
Can you say that about any? I mean, other nations. Well,
like you think about, like a lot of the US ones, a lot of the US battleships and everything were in reserve, or in the case of the Iowa, decommissioned straight out of the Navy into museum service.
So the Iowas are an exception, but I mean, even reserve is. There are many different tiers of reserve.
Yes,
There's reserve where you can rip off the plastic covering and fill the ship with crew and oil and food. And then there's reserve where you've got to pump the water out, dredge the bottom, slosh it out of the back water, and hope it doesn't sink on the way to wherever it's going.
But then you've got in the UK, you've got things like Great Britain, SS Great Britain, which is just like, yeah, we kind of abandoned it in the Falklands for a century. We're going to have to stick it on a barge. Warrior was a concrete-filled oil jetty over at Pembroke. Victory, before she began her preservation process in the 20s, was basically an interestingly shaped sponge. Bits of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we had to do a similar thing here. The city of Adelaide, we managed to drag down from Scotland before it fell apart too much. We've put it on a barge and drag it around here, halfway around the world, down to little old Adelaide to remember the clipper ship days here. But at least, you know, they haven't all gone the way of, was it Indefatigable?
The sail training ship,
but it was actually a ship of the line at one point. Then it became a training ship, then it became a training hulk, then it just became a hulk, and then they took it out to sea and blew it up.
Yeah, one of the only other ship that we had at the time that had been at Trafalgar. Yeah. Although, well, I must admit, actually, you know, the stupidity of destroying that poor thing was matched only by the stupidity of presumably the same person who decided to destroy it also decided on the method of destroying it. Because I don't know if you read the details of that.
Well, I haven't read it, but I do know that there is footage of it on YouTube. You can find it in the newsreel.
Yeah, the funny part you don't usually see on the news footage is that they loaded the hull with heavy ballast to make it sink. And then the geniuses that did that also put scuttling charges in the hold to, you know, let water in. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, this would have worked perfectly if this was a steel warship, but when it's a wooden warship that you have stripped of guns and literally anything else that is, you know, negatively buoyant, except for the heavy stuff you just stuck in the hold, then you blow open the hold, all the heavy stuff falls out of the hold, and now you just have a very large collection of wood with lots of holes in the bottom that merrily is floating around being a shipping hazard. And they've had to go in and more fervently break it up to make it sink, because it was just like, well, yes, I'm wood. What do you expect me to do? I'm floating here.
So I suppose it was too far into the age of steam. They'd forgotten the whole timber thing.
The whole wood floats bit.
These days, however, a lot of ships, even if they aren't preserved as such, they at least clean them up, cut a few holes into them, and sink them as diving wrecks.
Yeah, so, and they make good marine life habitats as well.
So, I mean, you know, that's pretty a good compromise.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Back to first subject. Which was, you know, why couldn't they have used the Indefatigable as a sail training ship to tidy it up, clean it up, you know?
Yeah, well, this is the reason we have this one on was actually I was just remembering a few weeks ago when I went to HMS Belfast and I saw the Japanese training ship Kashima tied up alongside and come over to the UK for a visit. And it suddenly struck me that, you know, when you think about training ships for sailors, i.e. something you can send people out to sea on to get an idea of how what it's like to live on a ship when it's at sea, what it's like to have duties and operate on a ship again at sea before you they actually, you know, put you in charge of a multi-hundred-million-dollar plus warship. There's not a tremendous amount of them still around. You know, back in the 19th century, the Royal Navy had purpose-built training ships, and then kind of like with the Indefatigable, they kind of went, you know, well, okay, as the Navy trended down in size, it started to become old second-line warships that were no longer viable frontline combatants but could still move.
You don't give the kids the keys to the Bentley.
No, and then these days, so through the 20th century, people seem to transition away from basically here's a what's effectively either purpose-built or retired second-line warship to give you a taste of what it's actually like to be a sailor without, you know, potentially starting a small war, over to either not having training ships or them being either stationary hulks or the tall ship sail vessels that we see these days. And yeah, I've not got anything against the tall ship sailing ship things. I mean, as apart from anything, as preservation vessel preservate ways of preserving these vessels, which are an important part of maritime history, it's absolutely great. But the point at which learning to sail with ropes and cloth and yards and everything, how much that's going to help you fight a war with, you know, anti-shipping missiles and everything. It gives you some basic seamanship training, which is better than nothing.
I mean, look, this is, you know, this is the whole thing, isn't it? There's so many different stages of training. And I suppose when it comes to something like a sail training ship, the idea isn't about warfare. The idea is about giving young recruits their sea legs.
Yeah.
And if you're going to get the sea legs, you're either going to get them on a sail ship or not. And that'll tell you whether you belong in the Navy or not. I mean, let's face it, when you're in one of those things under full sail and it's heeling over, you know, pitching through the water, you know you're in a boat.
Yes.
You know, yeah. it's not like it's fin stabilized and you know, cruise controlled. It's you're in a ship. But on top of that, you're also got the next level, which is you have to be part of a team. And on a sailing ship, every single person has to be pulling together literally on that line. And I guess it becomes sort of if it's a sail training ship, it's more of a rite of passage into a naval force, something that you'll remember for the rest of your life, one of those sort of defining moments of, you know, being out there, you know, sailor, rope, wood, block and tackle, sheets, you know, sails, the lot. And it's really is, you know, human versus elements. And you come out the other end with a huge sense of achievement, accomplishment, and camaraderie, I would imagine, if it succeeds, of course. I imagine that wouldn't have been the case with the Brazilian sail training ship a couple of years ago when it somehow or another managed to lose way and get dragged underneath a bridge. I wonder if that ever ended up back in service. It's a, you know, pretty tragic sight. But again, I'm sure, you know, as terrible as that was, it's better for that mistake to have happened with a sail training ship than, what did they rename HMS Ocean?
Atlantica or something like that.
Yeah, let's have a quick look. You know, that's what I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the sail training ships are more a matter of rite of passage, sort the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah.
Yes, it is Atlantica. And and building up a sense of place and a sense of team spirit. but yeah, you know, which you're not going to get, you know, with your foot going through the rusting deck of HMS Birmingham.
Yeah,
tied up in the back swamps of Portsmouth.
Yeah, and I suppose I think this is kind of the point I was getting at. It's like the sailing ships, they do, as you say, they do have a role in training people. Then you have ships like the Kashima, which, apart from, you know, firing weapons, they're kind of, I guess, the next level up of they would basically get you used to the day-to-day activity and life on a modern warship. Plus, you get to go and see a lot of places, give you an idea of where you might end up being, eventually form connections with other allied navies and so forth. And then you deploy out to, you know, your first actual assigned vessel.
So I guess this is the high school level, because Kashima is a purpose-built, designed floating classroom. And like any good classroom, it has the implements and tools and laboratories and workshops that are relevant to your intended career. It just so happens that, you know, that includes things like guns and radars and the like. But, you know, it's got all the rest there for the engineering teams and the damage control teams and things as well. And in a, you know, probably in a readily accessible, safe format for bumbling, you know, new recruits. So yeah. It's a different league from your sail training ships, isn't it?
It is, and the thing is, on top of that, you know, the Japanese Navy is not exactly, although Kashima is the flagship of their training fleet, you know, the clue's in the name, they actually have half a dozen or so training ships, including a training submarine, which to me seems like a very good idea into, you know, the Japanese are kind of this slight, as we've said before, slightly unsung force at the moment in terms of their size and capabilities. And then you look at what the Royal Navy's got, and well, we don't, basically. We have a few boats that can sit around, you know, they can toodle around the coastline, rivers and stuff, which can do some very basic handling. But we don't have an active at-sea training sub, and we definitely don't have an active at-sea training vessel of this kind.
And you don't give your new recruits any sense of initiation.
Mm.
Yeah, look, you know, it's it's money, isn't it? You know, but yeah. Where do you, you know, there's always that case where, you know, you save money can come with a cost. And if you don't have your crew bumping around a few jetties and, you know, tapping the sides of a few other ships unintentionally, you're going to, you know, in a safe vessel, or in a vessel that you're not going to immediately fire every single person with a bit of braid on them for getting a bit bent, then you're going to have a lot of very scared and timid sailors and commanders and captains. I mean, I guess it goes back to what we were saying before. You know, navies these days no longer have that sort of third tier of the small ships, no sloops, no corvettes, maybe a few patrol boats. But, you know, where do they go to get their practice and their experience? Or do they go straight to a you know, air warfare destroyer or a general purpose frigate from the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, the US Coast Guard has the Eagle, which is kind of one of those sailing ones. But there's a lot of things to unpack, because there's, you know, like you said, if you put someone who's brand new on a ship, let's say they're a brand new officer, cadet, etc., you can stand watch on land, you can stand watch at sea, on one of your little boats just offshore, but that's really nothing compared to being able to go and actually stand watch in a really busy shipping lane in charge of a multi-thousand ton ship. And sort of similar to what you were just saying, like Kashima a couple of years ago bumped into Queen Elizabeth II, not the carrier, the cruise liner. But that was quite, I mean, it kind of bears out the point, because on the one hand, yeah, that's the kind of mistake you'd expect rookie sailors to make. On the other hand, it was a training ship, so A, it wasn't as large, so it didn't cause as much damage to QE2, so that probably saved everybody's insurance bills a bit. And two, because they had a bunch of training ships, even though it was slightly embarrassing, they could just go, okay, well, guess what? Next training exercise, buffing out the dent. It didn't take a frontline warship out of commission into a dockyard to repair hundreds of millions of dollars and worth of equipment.
Didn't automatically result in the firing of, as I said, every single experienced person on board.
Yeah.
So,
I suppose it's also going to, if you don't have these kinds of things, it's also going to contribute to the stress and workload of the crew. Because if you have your theoretical, you know, fresh behind the ears lieutenant who's never actually stood watch on, let's say, Type 45 or an Anzac or a Burke or whatever, do you really think even a few months into the voyage, do you really think the captain or the first officer is going to turn around and go, yeah, okay, that's fine, off you go, I'm off to bed, have fun? You're going to have a shadowing program. You'd be irresponsible not to, which to an extent is fine because it's kind of learning on the job and picking up knowledge from senior officers. But on the other hand, it means that senior officer has to do their own duties and shadowing somebody who may or may not be about to make a catastrophic mistake, which now means that there's still the possibility of the said catastrophic mistake happening. And now whichever senior officer or officers you've assigned to these roles is going to be more stressed out and more tired, which actually makes the likelihood of that mistake happening even more likely, because even when the new guy is off doing other things, you've now got an officer who is expected to be able to stand watch on his own, who might be half delirious with fatigue.
I mean, you know, you hear stories of, you know, midshipmen doing their first, you know, watches on board battleships during World War II and the likes. But again, that was World War II, and, you know, they weren't as complicated as ships are now, and the shipping lanes weren't as crowded then as they are now. You don't get things like, then you didn't get things like GPS spoofing that's happening on an increasingly level, high level. Things like AIS distortion, you know, is happening on an increasingly high level, and even manipulation of the computers and the map charts in your computer system map charts. Again, that's something I was listening to on SimSec Sea Control. The extent of the cyber intrusions on warships, well, not warship, but just ship systems over the past 4 or 5 years has been extraordinary, and it's terrifying. That if they, you know, if you can hack into a ship and change your position on the map. Now, you've got to have a degree of self-confidence to think, hang on, that map's not telling me the right thing. Because if you don't have the self-confidence, you'll say, oh shit, I got it wrong. I'll trust the automatically updating map.
Yeah.
And bang, there you go into that rock.
Yeah. And you've got to have the seagoing experience to not just to trust yourself, but to know that something's off. You know, if the map is showing you X, if this is your first time out at sea and you look out and you're just like, it's the ocean. Okay, I guess it must be right. Whereas if you are a more senior experienced officer or you've had training beforehand in how to do manual navigation, you might be looking around and going, well, actually, you know, I can see that the water is changing color over there, i.e. we're going into shallower or deeper water. According to the map, we shouldn't be doing that. And the physical evidence suggests that something's wrong, or I can hear breakers nearby, or all these other.
I can see a lighthouse, which I shouldn't be able to see because theoretically it should be over the horizon given the height the lighthouse is and our distance.
Or even, to be honest, I can smell that we're close to land. I found very interesting ages ago when I was reading it. You know, when you go towards the beach, people associate the smell of the sea Whereas for sailors, it's actually the smell of the land, because what that smell is actually all the briny, decomposing organic material that washes up on shore, which is just in a band around the coast. So if you're on land and you smell it, you're like, oh, the coastline is nearby. That's nice. Whereas if you're a sailor and you think you're out at sea and you smell that, you're like, that's not good. If we're close enough to smell the seaweed, we really, really are in a bad position at this point.
This, which brings me back to the sail train, the value of a sail training ship. Most of your recruits these days are going to be urban.
Yeah.
Urban, you know, you don't have the maritime traditions anymore. Just because you don't have the maritime jobs. You have ships that are large, very large, but highly automated. And with, you know, the cheapest possible crew they can hire under a false flag. And the smallest, I suppose, you don't have to feed them as much. But so you know, you're not, I mean, while most of your recruits probably have some degree of familiarity with the coast, I doubt they're going to have much more than, you know, I doubt a large percentage of them is going to be urbanites who've done a bit of holidaying on the water, or have been inspired by watching U571 or something like that into joining the Navy. It won't be because their family, well, not as much as the family has been at sea for generations, and you know, I grew up in the coastal city, and my tendons are made of rope kind of situation.
Yeah, and I suppose that there's also another thing to be said for sort of proper training ships, is that they I think, from my estimation at least, they offer a nice intermediate point between soft power and gunboat diplomacy, because they are commissioned warships, even if they don't necessarily carry any armament beyond ceremonial saluting guns, but they are commissioned ships in a particular navy, so that has that certain element of gunboat diplomacy, but they are quite obviously not a threat. You know, they couldn't do any damage beyond ramming something, even if they wanted to. So they're not necessarily going to offend people or inflame tensions in the way that a full-on warship might. And at the same time, it's a bunch of, you know, it's still a bunch of sailors, albeit some of them might be young, a lot of them might be young trainees, but they're able to go to places to, you know, represent their nation, to help out if necessary, you know, in the event of disaster relief, or just, you know, being there for some kind of ceremony. There's a lot of willing hands, and if they're not willing, they're just going to be ordered to do it. And it also
you're in the Navy now, son.
Yeah, and it also doesn't diminish from the actual warship strength that's available for deployments. So if you need to go and help someone out with a small matter, or you just want to remind people that, hey, we're around. If you send a full warship, then that's a warship that's not available for warship business. Whereas you send a training ship, you accomplish everything that you need to without diminishing your frontline combat strength.
Now, I'm just thinking of a situation, you know, in the South Pacific, where, you know, China and Australia and the United States are all now sort of competing with each other, out trying to beat each other, and beat each other for the likes of the Solomon Islands and Micronesia and Fiji. And it all starts to look a little bit too much like, you know, schoolyard bullies beating their chest. Whereas you can probably have that same sort of effect, but a much more relaxed soft power impact. If you send along a training ship with a bunch of joyous, happy young kids, you know, and their schoolmasters, around to have a visit of these islands and prop up the local economy, and as you say, do a little bit of local work, and it's almost a school exchange process, because you can do the same thing while you're there. You can invite their naval police or whatever on board and give them a few lectures, a few classes, invite them over for lunch.
Yeah, and it's going to be much less sensitive. You can invite a lot wider range of guests without having to freak out about somebody spying on some sensitive radar or missile system, because your training ship doesn't have it.
Exactly. And yeah, I can see that there's just so many different layers of utility in a vessel that would hopefully not prevent you from buying another frontline warship.
Yeah.
I mean, it might prevent you from buying a few more OPVs or another OPV, but for the cost of an OPV, if you can get something like that, the benefits are just going to keep flowing.
And all it has to do, I mean, obviously it's an avoidance cost, which is very difficult to enumerate to people in accounts departments. But, you know, all you'd have to point out is, you know, what is the frequency at which our ships have smashed into things they probably shouldn't have, you know, or otherwise sustained significant damage.
On top of that, what is the frequency of a fresh young commander hooning about in your shiny top of the line Arleigh Burke?
Yeah.
Versus them having blown off a bit of steam in a training vessel of some kind. That so if you do suddenly rear end something, you're not going to be in anywhere near as embarrassing a situation.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, all you have to do is go, so here are all the incidents which have cost us a lot of money when something's gone horribly wrong that really shouldn't have and can probably be put down to people being either somewhat over eager or possibly some gap in their training. And then this is how much a training ship costs. It's probably only going to take, if that training ship, even if it only manages to avoid one of those incidents happening in over its service lifetime, it'll have more than paid for itself. Because the cost of repairing a warship is a little bit high these days.
Yes, and you wouldn't have to build it, of course, to full military spec. Although I'm sure you'd want to have a few watertight doors and stuff in there just to get them used to having to go through them. But as you say, the alternative is fit out an old warship.
Yeah.
I guess that works to a degree, but the old warships tend to need a lot of tender, loving care to keep them going, which is probably a good place to learn some of those skills. But the kind of things that would be going wrong would be the sorts of things that aren't necessarily on page one of the instruction manual. So you'd probably also need your to have more than just one or two very experienced crew around as well, just to keep the thing going. So you're sort of losing, you're taking away from an operational ship someone to nursemaid an old vessel that's tired and knackered, basically. Whereas they could actually be on board your Type 45 and making sure that the engines don't overheat again. If you get yourself a fresh training ship that's going to last 30 years before it gets to that point where you're going to start pulling it apart.
Yeah, but I suppose that then runs into the issues of, again, as you said earlier, about people willing to pay for things. Is there a warship that you can decommission into a training ship role without it just sinking the next year? Because when you look at a lot of the older ships back in the day when these were converted, a ship from a class might have been turned into a training ship, but its sister ships might have continued serving in that same Navy for another 10 years. And that training ship might stick around for 15, 20 years because it's not being used quite as hard. Whereas these days, an awful lot of ships are basically driven up to life expiry or beyond, at which point it's probably not safe to turn them into anything else.
We won't mention Ticonderogas in that sentence. I think it's, in terms of Australia, we converted a Daring class destroyer, I think it was Vampire, into a training ship. I think I, I, I think they pulled the X turret out and just built a tin shed over it and turned it into a classroom. I'm glad they did that because it meant that when they were in a mood to preserve a historic naval ship, it was still around. So therefore, they were able to, if it was the vampire, they were able to pull the tin shed off and put the X turret back on. And now it's moored there in nicely in the Sydney Harbour. If it hadn't been a training ship, it would have just gone to the wreckers, I suspect. So training ships might be a quasi way of preserving ships. So, you know, I mean, maybe there's an argument there. I mean, was Belfast a training ship?
She served stints doing training, but she was in the reserves at the time that there was a move to preserve a vessel.
Right.
This is kind of a reflection of the older system where using warships as training ships, sometimes some of the older warships would actually pop in and out of service as training ships. You see this quite a lot in the 1920s and 1930s, even in the run-up to World War One. You look at ship service histories, and they're not obsolete, but they're not the latest and greatest. And so they start to sort of blip in and out of active commission, and you see them sort of being taken out of service in, say, 1910 or 1932, and then used as training ship for 5 or 6 years before being paid off and then suddenly recommissioned back into active service because the war's begun.
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess to some people that sounds attractive. But then again, I suppose is it an ideal learning environment? Because you don't have that extra space in that radar operator's booth for the trainer to look over your shoulder. And explain what's going on. You don't have the extra space around that turbine for people to stand around and look at the teacher pulling apart a component and demonstrating the pros and cons of using a substandard replacement part or something. It becomes much harder to train, but then you get potentially a second line / first line ship of the line again at the end of the process. But I mean, well, that's what they were hoping to do with Bristol at first, wasn't it?
Was used as a training ship, albeit most of its time spent moored in Portsmouth for a good long time. But again, this kind of, it presupposes, using that approach presupposes that you have enough warships that you can afford to send one off into a training ship role for several years and not really miss it, as long as you can get it back in an emergency. Whereas, these days, a lot of the navies where you'd be looking at them going, you probably could use a training ship. They also really can't afford to drop a warship from their frontline inventory because they don't have that many.
Well, let's face it, if you dent a Type 23, it's going to be a hell of a lot more expensive than if you dent Kashima.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think this is the other problem, is that at this stage, if you did take a Type 23 out as a training ship and somebody dented it, then it would probably be deemed not cost-effective to repair it. Mm-hmm. And then it would be, popped back, but probably just sent early to the scrapyard, which again doesn't help.
But I mean, I guess once again, an alternative could be having a fleet of smaller vessels. Australia's got patrol boats. I'm sure that's where most of our more senior captains and officers cut their teeth on the small ship.
Mm-hmm.
A bit more nimble, a bit more zippy. A little bit less mass, to count into the momentum when it goes bump into the pier. Maybe you probably get more value from a small group of patrol vessels instead of having a Kashima. Because let's face it, most of those patrol vessels are barely naval standard anyway. I mean, they're I mean, obviously they're built as purpose naval vessels, but exactly the, you know, whether or not they've got carbon fiber, you know, armor here and there, it would have to be questioned, I suppose. That'd be more of a merchant grade construction level, I think.
Yeah, it's
because it's, at least that way you're going to have, instead of having one, instead of, again, you don't really have your classroom, but at least you've got three or four vessels where you've got watchkeepers active at any, you know, and you can rotate them around. You can always have one of these patrol vessels at sea, whereas when you've got a single training vessel such as, you know, Kashima, you're going to have to do its cycle, you know, one third active, one third, you know, not active, one third under deep maintenance, which sort of means it's not, doesn't necessarily fit with the school year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing, the training ships don't have to be the same size as a warship. I mean, Kashima is only four and a bit, just over 4,000 tons compared to, you know, the latest and greatest Japanese combat vessels, their frontline combat vessels, which, you know, pretty much like most of the other top end destroyers are over 10,000 or pushing it. I mean, even a Type 23, you know, I think even a Type 23 is a bit heavier than Kashima. But, you know, there's, you don't have to be full-sized, warship-sized to train people in how to operate a full-sized vessel. And I mean, okay, she's not quite as large as Belfast in physical dimensions, and Belfast, a 10,000-ton treaty cruiser, but she's surprisingly close to it for something that's less than half the displacement. But then, of course, she doesn't have, you know, several inches of belt armor and heavy gun turrets and everything.
Yeah. But, you know, just thinking in terms of the Armidale class patrol boats of Australia, you know, 300 tons. You know, it's got a pop gun up the front. It serves a purpose, patrol. And what's its crew? 21 crew, 29 maximum. You know, that's for a ship, you know, probably have a third of that as your greenhorns, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not the nautical type. And you'd still be able to prevent the thing from sinking immediately. So, yeah, look, I mean, interesting subject, but you've also got a museum ship that maybe should be turned into a training ship to make sure that it doesn't sink.
Yeah, so this is actually, well, it's got various reasons for preservation, but you know, people may or may not have heard of HMS Bronington, which was an old minesweeper. Not the world's largest vessel, but probably its main claim to fame was that Prince Charles of the UK, during his brief naval career, was in command of it. And it was briefly a museum, and then about six, seven years ago, it sank at its moorings. After it was basically abandoned following the enforced closure of the Warship Preservation Trust in Liverpool, or Birkenhead to be more precise. But now there is an effort looking at, you know, can it she be raised, reconditioned, and then preserved as a museum ship, which would be an interesting one.
There's only one point here, is that surely the votes would be tied between preserving it, because it was captained by Charles, and sinking it as a target because it was captained by Charles. It's the whole Republican monarchy thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's two sides to it. Yeah, one is obviously the only reason she's getting any attention at all is because of her involvement with the monarchy. On the other hand, if they do raise her and get her back to floating condition, she's probably going to be the last purpose-built minesweeper in the country. Yes, so you never know when we might need her back.
Minesweepers are terribly neglected. So it's one of the old Tun classes. So 1953.
Yes, she's in a Tun class. And interestingly enough, built of mahogany. So to be perfectly honest, given the price of that stuff these days, even if it is a little bit salt water damaged, I'm surprised no one's tried to salvage her for the wood.
Maybe they have. Yeah, has anyone actually chucked at the hull lately? Look, I mean, but again, you know, it's not big. If you can get it into a kind of mobile condition, which probably is a big ask, because I imagine the engine's wrecked, that, you know, it's the sort of size that would be a good training vessel.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, and being a minesweeper, it's, well, I guess that mahogany might be a bit rotten by now, but, you know, being a minesweeper, you'd normally expect it to be able to handle a bit of a bump.
Although of all the woods to be submerged for several years and possibly still be something close to intact, mahogany is probably up there as one of the better ones.
Right. Or maybe you can build a bunch of purpose-built minesweepers and use them instead of patrol boats as your training vessels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And since we're in the process of getting rid of the sand downs, which were our last mine hunters.
This is how old I am. I remember the scramble for mine hunters when Iran decided to start sowing a few mines in the Persian Gulf in the late 80s.
Which is where the sand downs come from, basically.
And everyone was panicking. Oh, no, we don't have any minesweepers. Oh, no, where are we going to get them from? Well, I think Australia still had, we might even have still had tons operating at that point. And now I guess generational change means that we've forgotten that mines exist.
Well, the Royal Navy is replacing the Sandowns with automated systems, although they haven't said what those automated systems are or how they're going to work. And whilst after the Naval Defence Conference, myself and Dr. Clark attended earlier this year, I'm perhaps a little bit more optimistic about unmanned systems in naval use in general in the upcoming years. The flip side to that is that whilst they have demonstrated a lot of capabilities and a lot of potential uses, mine hunting is not one of them. The last major Navy to try and develop a fully autonomous mine hunting capability was the MCM modules for the littoral combat ships. And they just flat out don't work.
And then there's the other question. What are you going to deploy them from? You're going to drop them from Typhoons?
Yes. Well, this is the other thing, isn't it? It's like it's all well and good saying, oh, we're going to have automated systems. Someone's got to take that automated system close to the minefield, which is kind
it's
of the whole point of system. Why you had the mine hunters in the first place. You didn't have to take.
And most of them deploy semi-autonomous vehicles to locate and exterminate the mine as well. Look, it sounds like another one of those situations where mine warfare is just too boring, too inconvenient for me and my budget, so let's just pretend it doesn't exist. But keeping Bonington, where would it go? And, you know, how would you make it, you know, I'm sorry to say this, but how would you make Bonington sexy for a museum ship? For people to actually
I think the fact that she's only about like 450 tons, a small ship, it's simultaneously a blessing and a curse, because by being a relatively small vessel, she can probably fit in a lot of areas that larger vessels couldn't. You know, you've got the Monitor M13, M33, sorry, in Portsmouth Historic Dockyard, which quietly sits, you know, quite happily, being a ship in a disused dry dock. And M33 is actually a bit larger than Bronington, which M33 is not exactly the world's largest vessel. So there is that advantage. You could go almost anywhere and probably actually could withstand, you know, she's probably of a size that could withstand being hauled up onto land for use as an out of water museum without too much difficulty.
Parker alongside that submarine.
Yeah, Alliance over in Gosport. The flip side to it is, of course, that because she is a small vessel, it's going to be very difficult to find somewhere that she can sit where she could be the main attraction. Because I think one of the reasons M33 works is that she's in there with Mary Rose and Victory and Warrior, etc. So she's another thing to see. She adds value to the Portsmouth Historic Dockyard experience. But in and of herself, even if you read everything, take in every audiovisual presentation, etc., you could be in and out of that ship in an hour.
Which isn't a bad thing these days, given that everyone's in such a hurry.
It's true, but if you're going to be in and out in an hour, hour and a half at most, probably half an hour for most, about half an hour, 45 minutes for most people, then a ship like that becomes an incidental thing that people might come and see as part of a larger thing. So you'd have to find a larger context to sit in to attract visitors, because in and of herself...
What about parking her in the front courtyard of Buckingham Palace?
Good work. I mean, again, you say that, but she is actually small enough. You probably could, with a little bit of finagling, get her there. but yeah, I mean, the idea of parking her up next to a submarine is not terrible, if there's space for it. U-534 unfortunately won't have enough space over in Liverpool, which is a bit unfortunate because it would literally be moving her a few hundred yards, 3,000 yards up the river. Alliance over in Gosport might be large enough. I mean, there's a fair bit of open space in Chatham Historic Dockyard. They do tend to use it for events and stuff, but you know, maybe they could be persuaded to add something to their collection. Because again, Chatham is another good example of what to do with smaller ships, because they've got Cavalier, which is a destroyer. They've got Ocelot submarine and Gannet and composite sloop. Again, on their own would probably struggle, but put them all together with all the other stuff that's at Chatham, and it builds up to actually, yeah, this is worth committing a whole day to, because there's a lot of things.
And let's face it, the whole mine warfare thing would be a fascinating extra element to add to that sort of collection.
Mm.
So maybe you should go over there and knock on their door next time you're visiting there.
That's true. Yeah, it could definitely be worth a shot. But you know, it's apart from anything else, it's nice to see that somebody is actually thinking about preserving ships for once, instead of just trying to feed them to the scrappers as fast as humanly possible.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm still, you know, banging my head against the nearest brick wall over that. The last ship from the Battle of the Atlantic sitting there on the bottom in Egypt.
Oh yeah,
I mean that, you know, that was such a missed opportunity. Well, the sloop
went. Was it called? Possibly Wimbrel. Was that destroyer? Wimbrel,
yeah.
And for the training enthusiasts as well, Bronington's run by a pair of Deltic diesels. So, if assuming that they're still there, it'll bring the training enthusiast audience in as well. So that's one thing. And I suppose the other two things that I had thought about ahead of time are both vaguely carrier related, one definitely, one possibly. So the Indian Navy has just recently taken pre-commissioned delivery of Vikrant, which is, I mean, it's a step for them in I think two ways. Firstly, because they now have at least once it commissions, more than one carrier hull, so they now have approaching a decent continuous at sea capability. The other thing is that it actually represents their first home, if you like, home built carrier. So it
took them a fair bit of time to get it up and running, but then they were prepared to put the time and effort into it, as opposed to abandoning it halfway through and or rushing it so that it's just a something to to bring out at weekends and show off. So, you know, they've certainly stuck with it, and they come out at the end with a ship that looks like it's got some decent potential. And I understand that they're currently testing launching F-18s off of ski ramps in order to give it an alternative to the Russian Su-31.
Su-31s, I think and they've got some MiG-29Ks as well to floating around. But then, to be honest, the Indian Armed Forces, they've got basically almost one of anything.
they have been talking about that as being a problem for a while. But you know, it's one of those things where does the money come from to suddenly consolidate? Yeah. And then also you've got a huge country with a huge number of roles. So,
yeah, yes. I think there's a degree of progress that you can see in the Indian Navy, although obviously it has taken them what, half a century of carrier operations to get to this point. But it's an interesting case study. Excuse me. Because initially the original Vikrant and then Virat they operated were both ex Royal Navy carriers, of course, Virat being the ex HMS Hermes of Falklands War fame. Then the one they've got at the moment, Viktor Meditsha, is a converted Kiev class. So they've kind of gone from buying somebody's old carriers to, admittedly, I think most of the work was done in Russia or Ukraine or some part of the USSR. But they have taken it as a slight upper level of going, okay, well, this is a ship we're now going to adapt or have adapted to our desires. And now with the new Virat, it's a case of, well, this is actually our own self-build carrier capability. And then obviously now they're talking about maybe building another one, not another Virat, but a larger vessel of some description in the future.
I mean, yeah, while they might not be able to push ships off the production line as fast as China, they can boast, unlike China, as you say, of having a carrier tradition. They've got carrier operations as part of their Navy going back to the time when they got themselves a Navy. It's part of the thinking. It's part of the culture. They would know how to get the most out of their vessels because they've been practicing it for a while now. You know, we're not talking battle groups, of course, but we are talking, you know, Indian Ocean Task Group with a carrier either in support or at its center. So, you know, that's more than pretty much anyone else can say. Apart from France and Great Britain, how many other countries have had a permanent carrier force?
No. I mean, even the French now, they've got one. So they don't have a permanent force.
Well, sorry, by permanent, I mean, you know, they've got a carrier all the time, even if it is undergoing refit. Britain can't even claim that, I suppose. But then again, because of the gap you went through there. But, some countries have had them here and there, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, again, all the old ex-Colossus and class.
Yeah.
So trying to think of any other country. Well, no, yeah, Italy's had a carrier of some kind for a while. And, you know, some places have bought a prestige carrier and then never actually used them.
Yes, this is true.
I think it's interesting. It'd be very interesting to see what's where we'll start seeing India's new carrier turning up, showing the flag. Will it do a return the favour of HMS Queen Elizabeth? Will it do the show the flag in Europe to prove that Iran. Oh my God. Sorry. To prove that India is a global power, you know.
Yeah.
That it can act, that it's or at least it's got a global navy that it can send its ships where they're needed when it wants to.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing. It's kind of, as I think we may have mentioned before, but it's the, in some ways, it's kind of, a carrier is kind of, it's the naval version of you must be this high to consider yourself a serious naval power. So them having it is it's as much about being able to get people to take them seriously as it is, actually having a full-on strike capability. Because as we said, there's a few other things that the Indian Navy and the Indian Armed Forces need to sort out for themselves before they turn around and say yes, we are a full-fledged frontline.
I would argue that India is probably in a very similar position to the United Kingdom in that regard, because it is the regional power for the Indian Ocean.
Mm.
And the Indian Ocean is very big, with lots of little islands scattered over a great distance. So those shipping lanes are vital. They're also very large. So having a carrier in that context is probably a good idea. Just as much as it is a good idea for the Royal Navy to have a carrier to support your naval and force deployment, but also to protect your shipping lanes, to help cover them with some kind of umbrella. So I can't really see, it makes a lot of sense. A carrier does actually make sense for India. Andaman Islands, Malacca Strait, then all the way across over to the Seychelles and to the Horn of Africa. It's a lot of area for it to exert its influence and to project its power. And I don't think that's the sort of thing that an LHD would be up to.
No.
And a decent sized destroyer would feel somewhat naked doing so. I think for India, it's more than just prestige.
Oh yeah, it's definitely much more than prestige, but it's tied in hand in hand. It's like, as you say, they are the regional power, but they couldn't really. I don't think they could really have turned around and claimed that with a straight face to everybody without having a carrier, because. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's similar to, having a first rate in the Age of Sail, or having ironclads in the 19th century, or having a battleship in the early 20th century. You can claim to be the regional power all you like, but if somebody else shows up in the region and they have a first rate, an ironclad or a battleship, suddenly you're not the regional power anymore, because you have, you can't touch them. And in the modern parlance, obviously, opinion is divided as to whether the modern capital ship is the aircraft carrier or the nuclear attack submarine in terms of offensive power. But let's face it, the Indians are going for that as well. I mean, they're renting one from the Russians. They're trying to build, I think they're trying to build some of their own. They may have already started. It all plays together.
That's why you have the quad. you suddenly have a team that's pulling together, such as that very large unit currently operating in the Pacific as part of RIMPAC.
Mm.
And I guess, wouldn't that be a sight to see? an Indian carrier at RIMPAC.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be quite fun. Especially if they, I mean, obviously the new Vikrant is a reasonable sized vessel, but it'd be even funnier to see if they get Vishal, their proposed new one, in service in the next 5-10 years or so, because that's supposed to be a Queen Elizabeth-sized ship, which would be interesting, the sudden proliferation of low-end supercarriers, if you like. before any of our angry US viewers write in and tell us, oh, that's not a supercarrier, I would direct
we need to
the fact the US Navy classifies the basically anything they built after the Midway class as supercarriers, and indeed the refitted Midways as supercarriers. And
why don't we just call them Marvel carriers? Justice League carriers, maybe.
Carrier expanded carrier cinematic universe phase one carriers.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's probably brought us to the end of this spouting of bilge.
Yep. Fair enough. It's been
next
fun.
Next episode will be
100.
The dreaded 100. Well, I suppose we've got to figure out what we're going to do with it, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, there's been a few ideas proposed, but I guess we'll probably have to hash that out over the rest of the week and figure out what exactly we are actually going to do. But we will be doing something special, even if it's just us sitting there going yay, which, you know, given our track record, it may turn out to be actually that.
Yes, things tend not to work out the way we want them to be all the time, but that's what it's like down here in the bilges. Thank you very much again.
No worries. See you around, everyone.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.